That was a little bit of Until the Real Thing Comes Along from saxophonist J.D. Allen's album Love Stone, with Liberty Elman on guitar, Greg August on bass, and Rudy Royston on drums. J.D. Allen is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast. This is episode 29, so if you're joining us for the first time, welcome, and I hope you'll check out the archives on iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. We're part of the Osiris Network, so visit osirispod.com to check out the 24 or so other shows they put out and see if any of them appeal to you. They've got shows about music, comedy, craft brewing, parenting, and much more, so I'm sure you'll find something else that you like. If you want to support us, please visit patreon.com/burningambulance and make a one-time donation or become a regular patron. I've been a fan of J.D. Allen's for about 7 years now. I first heard him in 2011 when he put out his album Victory, and I've followed his career ever since. In addition to leading his own groups, most notably his trio with Greg August and Rudy Royston, he was a member of Jeremy Pelt's quintet, a band that we discussed in episode 21 when Jeremy was my guest. He's also worked with David Weiss in the Point of Departure band, and with Cindy Blackman, with Orrin Evans, and with a lot of other people as well. On his last two albums, Radio Flyer and Lovestone, he's added guitarist Liberty Elman to his group. J.D. Allen is a very interesting player because while he's very traditional in some ways, he definitely comes out of the lineage of John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, and all the other classic tenor saxophonists of the 1950s and 60s. He's very original in other ways, and when you listen carefully to his music, you realize that there's a tremendous amount going on just below the surface. He's made a half dozen albums just with his trio, and each one of them is very different from the others. In this interview, we talk about many aspects of his career, his approach to the horn, where he sees jazz going, his catalog, and much, much more. I hope that you find it as interesting as I did. I'm going to play another piece of music now. This is Naked from his 2015 album Graffiti, and it's a duet between J.D. and Rudy Royston that opens the record. Later in the show, you'll hear music from Jeremy Pelt, from David Weiss, from Lisa Hilton, and from some other J.D. Allen albums. But for now, here's Naked, and after that, you'll hear our conversation. Thank you. up in Detroit, right?
Yep, that's correct.
Are you an only child? Do you have, you know, siblings?
Yes, I have two younger sisters.
Uh-huh. Are they musicians at all or no?
No, they're not musicians, but, you know, they, you know, we've all, you know, spent time with music. We used to have a singing group when we were children in Detroit. Yeah, so, you know, they decided to live the straight and narrow life, and I was the fool to try to continue in this madness.
Yeah. And how old were you when you picked up the saxophone, and was that your first instrument?
My first instrument was the clarinet at the age of 9, and I picked up the saxophone, I would say, around 14.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I started on alto. It was clarinet, alto, and then tenor.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And did you go to, like, jazz camp or go to school for music anywhere or anything like
no,
that?
No, I couldn't afford that, man. I was kind of afraid to try out for those things, but I definitely couldn't, you know, my parents or my grandparents couldn't afford things like that, you know, the jazz camp. That would have been nice, but no, I kind of picked it up. Not kind of, I picked it up at the clubs and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And I started going out to jazz clubs when I was 15. So that's basically where my training came from. You know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah.
Where did your interest come from? Was it something that your folks listened to, or, you know, where did it come from?
Well, that's a great question, and I can finally give credit to a person who led me in this direction. Was an aunt of mine who's actually so close, she's practically my sister, and I lived with her parents, and she introduced me to improvising, and she called it, she didn't call it jazz, she called it progressive music. And she said that, you know, that's what I was doing, was playing progressive music, and that was before I even realized I was doing jazz. I was just making up stuff. You know, I would hear something, and then I would take that and just kind of mess around with whatever I heard, just by ear. And she said, "Oh, you know, that's something that you can, you know, it's jazz, but she called it progressive music."
Yeah.
So she kind of pointed me in that direction, you know, in terms of investigating that. And I owe her the credit. I've never given her the credit in any other type of situation. So now I finally give her the credit, you know, Monica Ross.
Yeah. Now, I know you've spent some time in Betty Carter's band. Did you record with her, or was that just for live shows and stuff like that?
I didn't make the record. Mark Shum made the actual recording. He came after me, but there's one recording of me playing with her that WBGO was so kind enough to find and to alert me to. This was maybe, like, I would say 8 years ago. On the recording, it was a Toast of the Nation. It was like a New Year's Eve gig in Oakland, California. And I'm listed as John Allen, so they wanted to check to see if that was me. And that was definitely me playing all those wrong notes. So, yeah, that's the only audio I have with Miss Betty Carter.
Yeah. Does working with a singer give you an appreciation for songs as songs rather than songs as a set of chords, the way most jazz musicians think of them, I think?
Well, the working with singers, and I'm doing that a lot more, you know, I'm kind of revisiting that. A lot of singers are starting to call me to play with them, which is great. You know, but what the singer thing, what I noticed about that, especially with Miss Carter, was it was the song and the interpretation of the song by the members of the rhythm section, the way they treat singers in terms of volume, you know, different characteristics of making music itself, you know. So maybe they cater to the singer. That's a good band does that, you know, and when you're playing with a great rhythm section, they have a tendency to, you know, make the singer sound great. That's the purpose of a rhythm section, you know. So, putting the person on the mic in focus, that's something that I picked up from working with singers, and I kind of ask that of people that play with me, you know, the whole point is to make the front person look great, and then we all look great.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to Buster Williams a while ago, and he worked with a lot of singers, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and he said that
it was my assumption as a listener that the singer was kind of interacting with the piano player, but he said, no, the singer is working with the bassist. And the reason he got so many gigs was because he was regarded as a really good bassist for a singer.
Okay. Well, he would know, so I have to agree with that. That is true. The thankless job of the bass player, you know, who usually is the last one to get the credit for making everything work. You know, that's certainly true.
Yeah, yeah. Now, tone-wise, you seem to come out of a classic tradition. You've got that kind of big Coltrane, Rollins, Charlie Rouse, Dexter Gordon sort of sound. Are you consciously playing with that history, or is that just the voice that emerged from you, you know, when you picked up the horn? Like, what's the...
I like to think, well, you know, we all come from somebody, you know. It's kind of like when you're a person, you're a mixture of your mother and father, and you take on certain characteristics that sometimes you don't notice, you know, because you've seen them and heard them. So that's kind of how I look at my influences, and I celebrate that. I'm not embarrassed for that to come out. I don't consciously say, okay, this is coming from here and this is coming from there. It just comes out on its own in the subconscious. But consciously, yes, I'm referring to them, the masters, the titans, like Mr. Rollins, Mr. Coltrane, and Charlie Rouse, and everyone else that you mentioned. That they're definitely a part of me. You know, this is a conglomeration of a few people that just come out of me because I admire them and listen to them. So on the stage, it's in the subconscious. I'm not sure what's going to come out, you know, but maybe in any given situation, those spirits would come out in me, and I think that's important. You know, it gives a person depth, you know. Especially with the tenor saxophone, it's a rich tradition to have a beautiful sound. That's the ultimate goal. Not necessarily loud, but beautiful in any volume or register, you know, so... Yeah, those are the guys I listen to for in my book anyway.
That's the other thing that I was noticing, is that you have a very beautiful is a good word for it, and the word that I was thinking is you have a very disciplined sound. It's not like you never go into that kind of Archie Shepp, Pharoah Sanders, you know, territory. And or even like David Murray. You know, you never go that far out. And so I'm
That's interesting you say that. Because that's where I want to go next. It's so crazy you said that, because that's the next frontier for me, you know, to get to that. Well, I don't know about in terms of sonically, but definitely in terms of, being adventurous, you know. So those are the, I'm actually looking at the gentleman, in particular, Mr. Murray, you know. I'm really getting into, well, I've always been a fan of his, but I had to grow up to really appreciate what it is that he's doing. You know, he's a living master. So that's the next direction, man. That's a door I have to walk through, but I have to be courageous to do it. So I'm gearing up for that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of why I did the ballad album. So I can kind of do this next thing that I have planned, you know, so people can say, well, he can play, you know,
You're also a little bit unique in that you don't double on soprano or bass clarinet or anything like that. You only play tenor, at least, you know, that I've heard on record. So when did you make that decision, and how has it impacted not only your music, but your professional opportunities?
Wow. I actually lost an opportunity to play with Mr. Elvin Jones because of that.
Because he wanted a soprano?
Well, you know, I have to give you the whole story for you to really get a kick out of this. But for 3 years, every time the phone would ring, I would say, no matter who was around, that was Mr. Elvin Jones calling me about a gig. And people would laugh, oh, man, you always said that, da, da, da. But, you know, one day, I actually got the call. Mrs. Keiko Jones called me and asked me to come down to the Blue Note and sit in for a set. And he was auditioning tenor saxophone players. And it was a bloodbath when I got down there. It was Mr. George Garzon, Antoine Roney, and myself. And we were all up there playing. And at the end of the set, Mrs. Keiko Jones came up to me and said, okay, do you play soprano? And like a fool, I said, well, I do, but my voice, like I had a voice at, you know, 28, 27 years old, right? My voice is the tenor saxophone. And so I never got that call back, but I was playing with Cindy Blackman at the time. She said, you fool. I said, what happened? She said, yeah, I went down there. And Elvin said he was going to call you, but you didn't really play soprano saxophone. So I missed that opportunity to play with Elvin Jones. You know, of course, I did play with him one set, you know, auditioning for his band, but I lost the gig because I thought I had a voice and couldn't play anything else but the tenor. But so that's the professional opportunity that I lost with that. And in terms of just playing a tenor saxophone, you know, that's, you know, not to disparage anyone that might call me for soprano, but that is my voice. That's my singing voice. And, you know, that's what I hear when I sing. So that's why I play that instrument.
Yeah, yeah. Your first record was on this little Italian label, Red Records.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, most young artists these days start out either on Crisscross or Fresh Sound. So how did you get signed to Red?
Wow. Well, I did Crisscross after Red, but a gentleman, trumpet player by the name of Fabio Morghera, was kind enough to secure that date for me. I mean, he went to bat for me in terms of getting recorded. And the Sergio was the owner of the label, was having doubts because I didn't have a track record for recording. I'd done maybe two records, saying he didn't know who I was. He gave me the shot, and that's how that happened. You know, we had 2 days in the studio, and that was my first recording situation as leader, which was odd because if you notice, there are maybe two songs on a record with a piano player, but initially the whole recording was supposed to have a piano on every song. But I got into a situation with another piano player who would go on main, and I do love him, so if you hear this, know, my friend, that I do love you, you know, but it was a misunderstanding. He couldn't make the date, and so the rest of the tracks were just a quartet without the piano, and that was my first experience actually playing without a piano, but I actually really, really dug it. You know, it was something I said, well, I'm going to get back to that, you know, playing without a piano. So that record date was the genesis of playing without a piano just by accident.
Yeah, know? Yeah. And you did two other records for them, both with Fabio on trumpet. So what was your working relationship with him for those years there?
Well, he gave me a shot, you know. He at that time, I have to say, in all honesty, he believed more in me than I did myself, you know. And he simply made that happen. He put me on a date with, which I'll never forget, with the great Victor Lewis. He was on one situation. I think Steve Turay was on some things like that. And I kind of had gotten into the Red Record rotation for recording. And, you know, that was one of the first things where I was recognized on a label, you know, on an album cover as being a guest. And he made that happen. So I owe that to him for believing in me more than I did myself at that time.
Yeah. And you you mentioned Cindy Blackman. You were in her band for a couple of years and made two records with her. One of them was a double disc, actually. So what can you say about that experience? Because I listened to a little bit of that, and it was interesting music. It was like organ, you know, stuff, and you know.
Yeah, that was the lab. Wow, that a great master, someone who gave me an opportunity to play my own originals. And I think the biggest thing that I got out of that was learning how to take tunes apart and try to work them in different situations. We used to have like 6-hour rehearsals once a week where we just get together and take two or three tunes and see how many different ways we can play them. And she taught me how to take songs apart and find the best situation for the players that you have at hand. So I learned tremendously from her for just the art of investigating and searching within the tradition, you know. So I owe her a lot. I love being in that band. It was You know, there was a point where I left New York and I was in Detroit and no one at that time could find me. You know, I went home and I was dealing with some personal issues, and she had heard I left, and she called the Detroit jazz radio station and then told them to announce every hour that I'm looking for J.D. Allen. If you know where J.D. Allen is, please have him contact me, or contact me as to where I can find him. So people were looking for me in Detroit, and she bought me a ticket and had a, I didn't even have, have a saxophone at that point, got me a saxophone and brought me back to New York and put me to work, you know.
Wow.
So, oh, yeah, man. She was, she went above and beyond a leader, you know. She was a, she'll always be someone dear to me, you know. Just, she showed me how to, you know, how to become a leader, what it took to become a leader. And she was definitely a general. That was my general. And she brought me back, man, and put me to work and, you know, had me up front representing her music. So I owe her a lot, man, definitely.
Yeah. So in about 2008, about 10 years ago now, was when you kind of emerged all of a sudden, because that was when you you joined Jeremy Pelt's quintet, which lasted about 5 years. So how did that band come together?
Wow. I think how, well, me and Jeremy had played in a couple other situations. We played together with Renard Harper, of course, I knew of him. He just came to New York and was becoming very popular. But I think the thing that kicked that off was a recording by Gerald Cleaver, who was actually in his band also, by the name of Detroit. And we played that record together. And, I noticed that we had a pretty good blend in terms of just the front line. You know, I noticed it, but I didn't know if he noticed it, but obviously he did. And he sought me out and asked me to join his crew, and I was more than happy to do that, you know. And that's basically how that popped off, and I learned a lot from that also, you know, he's a great architect, and we talked about music quite a bit, classical music, all types of things, and Yeah, he's a great leader, man. He's somebody that helped me along the way a lot. You know, I still listen to him for inspiration. But Gerald Cleaver's band, recording by the name of Detroit, kind of sparked the idea for him to put that unit together.
Yeah, yeah. And was there a consistent vision from the beginning, like Jeremy saying, you know, this is the kind of thing I want to do, like take that mid-60s Miles Davis language and move it forward? Or, you know,
you couldn't help but that wasn't consciously said. What was discussed, at least with me and him, was taking that type of sound and owning it, you know, and making it a part of our voice. And I think, I know Mr. Marsalis went Marsalis, but I think they kind of did that with their earlier recordings. It, you know, took that type of sound and made it their own. So I feel like he was on that path, and I agreed with that. You know, like, you know, for me, Wayne Shorter was a big influence around that time, particularly the Wayne Shorter live at the Plug Nickel. Mm-hmm. And I think he was digging that also. So that kind of came out because we were listening to the same things. And it wasn't just Miles Davis, you know, it was classical music. We talked quite a bit about Prokofiev and Shostakovich. You know, I dug the Russian classical composers, and he was more into the French thing, you know. So, you know, it was kind of like looking at it like that, you know. But just so happened, you know, I could see how people would, you know, compare the Miles Davis thing with that, because that's where we were at that point, you know.
Yeah.
But we owned it, you know, which is nothing wrong with that. We owned it, and we didn't hide our influences, you know. And, yeah, that was fun, man. I learned a lot from that, man.
mm-hmm. Do you feel like that group lived its natural lifespan, or was there more to be said in that configuration?
Wow. Yeah, I think... Well, I'm speaking for myself, you know, I don't know where Jeremy's head was on that, but, you know, unfortunately, Dwayne Bernal, the bassist for that band, had passed away. And a lot of people don't realize, I mean, in my opinion, that band was actually Dwayne Bernal's band. No, really, man, we all reacted to what he was doing. You know, like any... Wherever Dwayne was at musically, I think he was probably the most advanced out of all of us. Wherever he was at, that's where the man went. So I think there was quite a bit more music to make, but, you know, I mean, cats started doing their own things, and you know, it was kind of hard to bring everybody together at a certain point. So Jeremy just, you know, he disbanded it. But I think it had some more miles to go, you know. Mm-hmm. that would have been cool. It would have been, I think we probably would have probably got more into the electric thing, which would have been hip. I know Jeremy was talking about that.
Yeah, and that's kind of the direction.
It never popped out.
That's kind of the direction he went after that. He did records with keyboards and stuff.
Yeah, well, he had done some stuff before that, prior to making the band, and then he went, you know, he went back to the acoustic thing. But, you know, I remember discussions coming up where we were talking about maybe getting into that type of thing, which I was totally for, you know. But I kind of started doing the trio thing, and it was hard to get it. And Gerald was doing Uncle June and things like that, so it was kind of hard to get everybody on the same page in terms of, you know, touring and things like that. So he disbanded it. You know, I understand, you know, but it still had some more miles. And it probably would have, I think, gotten back together at a certain point, but, you know, Dwayne Bernal had passed.
Yeah.
And everybody's still kind of, you know, shooken up about that one. No one expected that.
Yeah.
I did. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Now, your trio formed around the same time. So when you started that group, did you expect it to still be going 10 years later?
No, I didn't. I mean, wow. That I didn't expect that at all, you know. But here we are, you know. And everyone is doing their thing also, which is pretty cool. Rudy.
Rudy's everywhere, man.
He released a wonderful album, you know, great idea. And then there's one in the can he hasn't put out, but hopefully he would hear this and people would want to hear it, where he put out he recorded a solo drum record that I think is going to really shake the world up. So, you know, everyone is doing their thing. So, you know, sometimes we might all venture off at other points and then come back, you know, because that just keeps the water from being stagnant. But I think we're still together as a unit, you know. But, you know, if we venture off, that doesn't mean it's disbanded. It just means that people have projects coming up. Greg August has a project that I hope he doesn't mind me announcing, but at some point next year he's going to record his wonderful piece with Strings about Emmett Till. That I think is going to really, really shock the world, and I think it's very, very important. So looking forward to that. So everybody's doing their thing, and we come together when we can, you know, and we're still here, you know.
Yeah, yeah. How much of a democracy is the group? Because it's almost all your tunes, but I mean, like what you were saying before about the rhythm section, are they your rhythm section, or is it an equal partnership creatively, do you think?
Well, I think it's an ensemble situation. You know, I like to think of it like that. It's more of an ensemble versus, you know, I'm playing on top of it. And I probably have a jump on deciding which tunes we play because I'm up front and I don't know, I'm not quite sure if I can play their tunes correctly. So I play my stuff because I know it, you know. But, you know, I don't say anything to them when I bring a piece of new music. I kind of just let it happen organically, you know. And I feel like, you know, everyone puts their personal stamp on it, you know, and that's, but as far as playing other tunes, that rarely happens because I'm not sure I have the ability to play some of their stuff convincingly.
Yeah.
John Ellis. That's the man, you know. He could play anything.
You've done a couple of what could be called concept albums. Like The Matador and the Bull kind of had a theme, and Americana especially kind of had an umbrella over it. And Americana got a lot of press attention for you. You got written up in The Atlantic and stuff. I mean,
oh, man, I was very proud of it. I couldn't believe that, man, The Atlantic. Can you believe that?
Yeah, wow, yeah. Man. Did that help in any perceptible way? Like, did your bookings get better? I mean, I'm always curious, as someone who writes about the music, whether it actually does anything or not, you know?
Well, you know, still quite a few people who haven't heard of me yet, you know. I release a recording every year, and some people are just hearing Victory, which came out 100 years ago as far as I'm concerned. Or some people come in, hey, I just heard your new record, I Am, I Am. That's like 100 years ago. Yeah, I like to think we sound better, but, you know, it's every year it gets better in terms of recognition and bookings, you know, but it's a marathon, you know. I'm trying to stay fit and healthy enough to hopefully enjoy some of the fruits of our labor, you know, later on in the years, you know. But, Yeah, we get some work, and not as busy as I would like because it's a different climate. But I'm playing towards the future in terms of trying to leave something of worth, you know, when I check out of this place, you know what I mean? Something to say that I was here. Hopefully there will be one recording, you know, that's good enough for people to remember me by. And that's kind of where my mind is at, you know. So, you know, but yeah, it gets better every year, Phil. You know, every mm-hmm. year someone hears a recording and say, hey, you know, we like to bring you here. You know, it's been a long road, but, you know, I'm a tough cookie. I can hang in there.
It was really interesting. I talked to Oren not too long ago, mm-hmm. like right when he joined the Bad Plus, I interviewed him, yeah. or right when their record came out. And he was saying that before he joined the Bad Plus, like they were going to play some club in, I think, St. Louis, you know, was mm-hmm. like his first gig with them. And he said, you know, that club wouldn't have booked him as a headliner. He says, you know, I have a lot of records out, so people think I'm famous, but like there are clubs that they say, no, you're not going to draw, you know?
And yeah.
That's crazy to me, because I guess because I live in the New York media environment, I'm in the little mm-hmm. bubble. So, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, you know, I wasn't aware that I was in the bubble also until I lived in the Midwest for a brief period, and I realized, I mean, whereas we're here in New York and we think a shot here is a shot that's heard around the world, but you'd be surprised. I'm sure you're not surprised that there are other parts of this country and in the world that's very insulated and haven't heard, you know, what's going on in New York, you know, because everything's so saturated in terms of information, so it's hard to sift through what's going on here, mm-hmm. you know, so that's not surprising that had happened. I think he had mentioned a club out that way where he was talking to the guy, right? And he was trying to secure a gig, and he had said that to Oren. I hope Oren doesn't mind me telling the story, but I thought it was really weird. But so Oren was asking him, and he said, well, man, about drawing. He said, well, man, you know, the recording that we're hearing now, I'm actually on the recording that's playing while we're talking. And the guy didn't realize that Oren was playing, you know, which is weird, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, I mean, I understand it from a business point of view, you know, but from an artistic point of view and from a love of the music and community service in terms of feeding the world with beauty, I don't understand it, you know. So it's weird. It's a weird dynamic, you know, when people tell you, you won't draw. But I really believe in my mind that there's a reason for that, you know. It's just the way the radio is pointed in terms of people hearing, having access to art, and the perception that jazz is boring, you know. So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to make money, man. I understand. Everybody wants to eat, you know. Everybody wants a Ford refrigerator and bills paid. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. Well, I mean, the way I look at it, and I've said this to people, is like every artist is a niche artist now. Like there are people in there's 300 million people in this country. There are many, many millions of people who have never heard a Beyonce song.
Really?
I am convinced.
Really? Because, you know, she's so deep, she has her own radio station.
Yeah,
quite a few.
I'm telling you, there's people that just never, they know the name, but they've never heard it. Everybody has a niche, and it depends how big your niche is, you know?
True. Yeah.
But
I agree. Yeah, that's true. And I think we've gotten into the realm of... I only like what I understand or what I've heard before, but the whole notion of, oh, let me check this out. I don't know what it is, but let me check it out, you know. And I can equate this with this. You know, I love going to the movies, and one time I went to a movie not knowing what it was, not knowing what kind of movie it was. I said, well, let me just check it out. And I was thoroughly surprised, you know. I didn't know what was going to happen. So that doesn't happen as quite as often as it used to be in terms of people hearing things they never heard before. They want something that's familiar.
Yeah.
Because that sells, you know, they kind of bought, not they, but, you know, it's kind of a social engineering thing, you know, where, you know, the formula, you know, they want to hear the formula.
Mm-hmm.
It'll change, you know, I mean, hopefully, I'm not dead before it changes, but it will change, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, in 2008, also, you were briefly in David Weiss's Point of Departure band, which was interpreting material from the mid-60s. So what was your relationship to that material? Was that stuff, was those tunes that you were already familiar with coming in, or were you just like serving David's concept? You know, what was the...
For that, which was actually really cool, that music was the Detroit, it was a Detroit band, I think, called Point of Departure, where they wrote down, and I think they did like two recordings for Blue Note in the late 60s, early 70s. And it was kind of take their take on the Miles Davis quintet of the 60s music. And, you know, David asked me to perform that music. So it was kind of, it was weird. I was looking at tunes and I saw the names and tunes and I said, wow, I remember meeting Kenny Cox when I was 14, 15 years old in Detroit.
Oh, wow.
And I actually didn't know that he did that. It was like really, it was new to me. I said, wow, I didn't know those guys had a band. Like I had saw all those guys as a kid when I was starting out, you know, I would see them in Detroit and they weren't playing that way. You know, they were playing more like a bebop thing. And when I heard that music and when I performed it, I was really surprised, man. I was like, wow. So it was kind of a, for me, being that I'm from Detroit, it was kind of a tapping into the history of where I come from and their interpretations, you know, of that type of playing, you know. But yeah, Kenny Cox, I think Charles Moore, I met some of those guys and had no idea that that they did those recordings. You know, no one talked about it, but David had all that music, and he, you know, it was great to see, you know, learned a lot from that too.
Yeah, yeah. He's a really interesting guy because, I mean, I've been to see the Cookers and, you know, he's very much into sort of excavating the past and bringing it forward, you know, and honoring tradition and stuff like that. It's really interesting to hear his projects, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also I like to acknowledge this. David Weiss is usually the guy that hires the new crops that come into New York City. I mean, at any given point, you know, I try to make a point of checking out his bands because usually it would be guys that are just moving to New York and, you know, trying to make their way. And he usually ends up hiring the baddest cats, the new guys in town. So I think he is safe to say he holds the mantle of, you know, putting guys, young guys, and introducing people to new people that moved to the city, you know. He definitely, I know he hired me and I was grateful for that, you know, when I first got to town.
Yeah.
Hear some dates with him.
Thank you. So I'm curious about this. You've made about a half dozen albums now with the pianist Lisa Hilton. Mm-hmm. And she's really interesting. She's a really interesting case to me because I like her music.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. She's self-funded, so I'm guessing that she's like independently wealthy or something. I mean, what's mm-hmm. the story with her and with your working relationship with her?
I want to make sure I'm diplomatic about that because, you know, especially in the times that we're living in, you know, in terms of people who are fortunate to have situations where they can self-fund themselves. And, you know, let's be honest, her last name is Hilton. So when you see their last name Hilton, you automatically think, wowee, you know. She's a good friend of mine, man. And I will say this about recording with her. I've had an opportunity to play with Lewis Nash because of her, quite a few people, Larry Grenadier, Pat Metheny's drummer. He did some dates, not Sheet Waits. Jeremy Pell brought me into that circle. Mm-hmm. And what I respect about her, man, she is going to, you know, no matter what, she's not. I respect her perseverance, like how she sticks with it no matter what, you know. And for me, I don't mind recording with her because she's going to try it, she's going to give it a shot, and she's brave, you know. You know, so it's always a fun situation, and it's great to hear her progression on each recording, you know. So and you know, she's a personal friend, man. You know, I call her sis. And we check in on each other, and I've met some of the Hiltons, man. That's a very beautiful family. Sometimes they show up at our gigs. You'll never know that they're Hiltons, but they show up and just say, hey, you know, just dropping in and say, hey, you know, the Hiltons are a cool family. Mm-hmm. The Marriotts are also cool too. You know, something about those hotel families, you know, they junior, pretty cool.
Yeah.
At least to me, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, the music is, you know, it's good music. It's not like you're being hired to, you know, play at somebody, you know, like, oh, my niece wants to make a record and, you know,
yeah,
something like that. It's. I mean, she composes all these tunes and then once a year she comes out and makes a record, you know?
Yeah, and there's always an interesting backstory from her perspective about life, you know, and it's usually something that I wouldn't have thought of or had, you know, or been in the realm of something like that. And you know, it's very serious, you know, and she gives me room to interpret it, and my goal in that situation is to try to make it work. And I have fun, man. I haven't done, I think the past two, she might have done a solo recording and then a trio recording, but she gets better on each one. Mm-hmm. And I respect that, you know, she's doing her thing, and by hook or crook, she's going to reach her goal. And, you know, you gotta give respect to that, man.
Yeah. You know? And, I mean, I got to say, one of the records that you did with her was, it was your trio and her and, I think, Terrell Stafford, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We got, you know, we did a recording right after that. You know, that kind of was, that was a nice little introduction for 3 days. Like, oh, man, you know, we'll get back and do a recording of our own. But yeah, it was the trio plus Terrell Stafford.
Yeah.
That was a blast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the last couple of years, you've gone from a trio to a quartet. And what made you pick Liberty Elman? Because on the surface, it seems like you two come from different worlds, because he's from that kind of, you know, Brooklyn sort of avant-garde jazz world.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, like, he works with Henry Threadgill, I think, you know, and people like that. So how'd you guys connect, and what about his voice works for your band?
Well, I've seen Liberty throughout the years in personal situations. And I have to say, the thing that impressed me about Liberty Elman was actually his work with Henry Threadgill. You know, I really admire the way he plays behind Henry Threadgill, where he keeps a melodic line happening versus more so than a harmonic thing. And I would say what we do have in common, which I think is the utmost importance when I'm playing with someone, is that melody is king. And I feel that he believes that also. That's why, you know, he's able to be in a situation like Steve Coleman, Henry Threadgill, and then turn around and play a ballad recording and play it convincingly, at least in my opinion, and beautiful, you know. So he's a musician first. He's very musical. And, you know, and I look forward to doing more things with him, you know. I really enjoy playing with the guitar, you know, and he was the guy I thought of. Yeah. But that idea came from checking out Mr. Henry Threadgill, you know, his work with him.
Yeah, yeah.
Know, definitely.
And the first time you guys worked together, like, because you had, you know, you had this trio that's made 6 albums together, you know, and plus the Lisa Hilton thing, and plus Greg August's record where, you know, it was the three of you and some other horns. So, I mean, it's a tight, you know, it's a tight unit. So how does a fourth guy work his way in?
Well, any guy that's coming into that situation, whether it's with Greg or Rudy or any other situation, just simply has to jump in, you know, and swim for dear life like the rest of us, you know. Grab a lifesaver and join the swim, you know. And he jumped in, you know. We didn't have any rehearsals for the recording. We went to the studio. I kind of told him what records to check out. That was for Radio Flyer, you know, what I was listening to at that time, and you know, what a kind of a blueprint in terms of where you know, I would like to visit. And he checked it out, and he just jumped in, man, you know. And voila, you know. And then when we did the ballad recording, you know, we didn't have any rehearsals. I said, well, you know, I'm listening to these recordings, and then we went to the studio, and that's what we did, you know. And I like that kind of player, where a guy can, you know the framework and be on the same page in terms of what I'm using as a you know, inspiration. Check that out, and then put his thing, his take on it. And he's very adept at playing no changes and changes, which is the type of players I like, you know, to kind of walk in both worlds at any given time. So Liberty definitely fits that bill.
Yeah, that.
I feel bad sometimes, embarrassed, because my music is really so simple. And I said, man, I know you're used to playing with Steve Coleman and Henry Threadgill, man. I'm sorry I ain't got more complicated stuff, and everything's basically 4/4, but that's where I'm at. And he always laughs, you know. But he's able to function in it perfectly, you know.
Yeah.
Anytime.
The Radio Flyer, I mean, it was very free considering everything that had come before. It showed a really different side of you. I mean, the title track to me almost reminded me of like primetime era Ornette Coleman in a way.
You're right to say that, definitely. And ideally, you know, funny thing is, I wanted the whole record to sound like that. You know, but I didn't know how to explain it. Because usually I record some stuff, and like there's one tune on every record that kind of points to where I would like to go. And the title track, Radio Flyers, you know, where I want to work in that world. I want to take a walk down that street. I was checking out Primetime, and that he nailed it. But I would have liked to have had everything kind of come out of that direction. It didn't that particular day, but in the future, that's something I would like to investigate also.
It's interesting, so too, because
pain, you know?
I could hear a little bit of an Ornette-ish approach to the blues on Americana sometimes, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like that Texas blues thing kind of attracts you in some way.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. Well, I think any tenor player worth his salt has to give credit to the Texas tenors. The tenor saxophone in particular, for all intents and purposes, especially in the 20th century, it's known and championed by people, tenor players from Texas. You know, you have Arnett Cobb, you know, a lot, Illinois Jacket, even who else? All the way down to Shelly Carroll was a great tenor player. You know, it's just a long. Ornette Coleman definitely from Texas played tenor. He started out on tenor. So yeah, I've made a point to investigate and, you know, tune in to that tradition. You know, which is sound. You know, mm-hmm. a full body sound and underlining thread of blues. You know, so yeah, that you're not wrong to say that. You know, the Texas thing is in there. I'm glad you noticed that. Now, sometimes I'm not sure. Booker Irving, you know, just cats like that, mm-hmm. they have the cry in their sound. You know, I think that's where the cry comes from.
Yeah,
it's Texas.
Now, tenors. The new record is almost the direct opposite of Radio Flyer because it's ballads mm-hmm. and it's all outside material. So, mm-hmm. I mean, tell me how the idea came to you and kind of how you approached it, because you have this kind of big voice, you know, and so to mm-hmm. bring that down for ballads is kind of a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I have to give you the credit for that. And I did a Jazz Is piece recently. It was we talked for maybe 6 days for this interview, and he asked me that question, where did it come from, and I mentioned that it came from you. He didn't put your name in the article, but now I am saying that you were the one that was the gave me the idea. I remember seeing something you wrote about and this is not a knock against the music that's going on now, at least from my point of view, but you said, wouldn't it be nice to just hear a melody, you know, and just play basically just play a song and not the math and science thing. We could just from what I gathered, what you were saying, the human element of it, mm-hmm. whereas, and what I took away from it was, you know, we've gotten to the point where, at least in my opinion, where a standard or playing a ballad or a standard, a song that isn't composed by an artist is the avant-garde at this point in time. You know, because now everyone is expected, you got to be this composer, you know, it has to have all of these, you know, the glitter in it versus mm-hmm. just someone playing a song with, hopefully with meaning to it, which was 9 times out of 10, if it has meaning, it has lyrics, you know, the older songs anyway. So when I saw that particular situation that you wrote down, that was kind of the light bulb went on. It's like, man, you know, this cat is right. You know, everyone's trying to see trying to outsmart the next person versus just trying to play something beautiful that someone can just appreciate, you know, for the people, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Now, whether someone listens to the ballads and get that, you know, this is for people versus just for musicians and critics, I don't know, but that was my intent behind doing a ballad recording. And I have to tell you, that was the hardest recording that I've done to date. You know, I mean, it was harder than writing my own material, man, just trying to find that stuff and find the right songs that would fit, you know, my sound and things like that. That was very frightening, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
it was very frightening, man.
Because a ballad
I did
is...
it, so that's out the way.
I mean, you're really exposed on a ballad, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's
oh,
like,
yeah.
you know, you because every phrase, there's a, you know, there's time to absorb it before the next phrase comes along. So it's rough.
I mean, and a ballad is so anti now, you know, it's not high speed. It's not a flash in the dark. It's kind of a melancholy thing and making you, at least in my opinion, tune into some emotions that everyone experiences at some point in time, hopefully. You know, everyone can relate to love lost, wanting love, or all that kind of great stuff, you know, mm-hmm. I think. And trying to convey that emotion to someone that you too recognize those feelings can be tough, you know. And it's frightening and a very naked feeling, you know. And I'm still worried that I hope we weren't being corny, you know, because I was worried. That was my biggest fear. Like, oh, man, we're gonna look like some cornballs, man.
Yeah. You know. So you have two sons. I saw a video online of you playing with them. Mm-hmm. How hard did you have to push to get them to take up instruments, or was it them?
Oh, wow. That, you know, you know, my son Elijah has a trumpet, and he named his trumpet JD. And I said, man, please don't name it JD, because he might get mad and throw it against the wall, you know. you know, it wasn't something that I said, okay, you have to play an instrument. I think, I will say this. The beauty of that, when your child does something that you do, is that it instantly brings about a conversation. You know, and I think that was their way of connecting with me, you know, and like being a part of me, because you know, they're seeing me do my thing, and you know, they're involved in the music world. They see these artists, and fortunate enough, they're able to see and meet great musicians, and they want. I feel, in my opinion, they wanted to connect, and I thought that was brilliant of them, and I welcome that. But I tell them, like, hey, man, you know, the minute it's not fun, stop. You know, because it was, for me, I say it was never not fun. It was not something that someone had to force me to do. I wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. It was my way of making friends and things like that. So I said, you know, do it because you want to do it, not because you think that's something I want you to do. And they're sticking with it. And actually, they're getting pretty good at it, man. You know, I'm really impressed with their progress. And they're able to invite their friends. Like at certain points, I remember earlier in the year, I was at their house, you know, giving music lessons to their friends for free. And it would be like 5 to 10 kids in the house with pizza, and then we would get together and play out, no changes. And we see, play angry, play sad, and then we would work on scales and stuff like that. So, you know, I think it's safe to say that they're a part of a new current of musicians that are coming up. Under the younger musicians than me, the ones that are younger than the guys that are popular now, mm-hmm. where they want to play so-called traditional music because, you know, they've heard all of the rap, and they're technology is not a new thing to them, so they want to get back to doing things with their hands, you know. So, you know, my boys are, you know, they're in that realm. But I said, man, look, the minute it's not fun, man, totally stop. Play baseball. Go skateboard, man. Enjoy yourself, you know, because your childhood should be fun, you know, not something where I'm playing this instrument because I want to get out of a bad area of town or out of a bad town to a better life, which is kind of what my intent was, you know, with the music thing. It was my ticket out of Detroit. Mm-hmm. My ticket away from the car factory, not to put down the car factory, but my ticket to, like, you know, seeing other parts of the world, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm saying they're doing it to have, you know, because they love it. And, like, that's something that we share, you know. That's something that we can talk about, which lends itself to other kinds of conversations, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be a young audience for jazz these days with, like, Winter mm-hmm. Jazz Fest and within, you know, within certain realms of the music anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, new, like, there's places like the Jazz Gallery where you actually have a show coming up, you know.
Yeah,
the people the people that show up there are younger, you know. And mm-hmm. do you feel like that's a zone that's open to you generally? Like, what do you see as your audience these days?
Wow. Okay, the younger audience, I'm meeting them. The younger musicians that, especially since I've been back in town, you know, I'm starting to meet younger musicians. So obviously they have younger friends and they bring them around. I think there is a niche that is open. And I've been a part of that niche, similar situation in terms of playing with Betty Carter, you know, and I think that is something that I think in my generation, my crew of guys, it's our responsibility to play with younger musicians who are trying to, you know, cut their teeth, you know, and be led and share some of the things that we've learned, you know. Mm-hmm. So that younger audience it's my responsibility at this point in time to hire them, to be around them and see what they're doing so I can replenish my thing and keep growing. You know, I had a wonderful conversation with Antoine Roney, who's actually doing that, Cauldron Running's his son. And there's a whole group of musicians with them, and his conversation was deep, man. He taught me, because he's a mentor of mine. He said, man, you know, when I quote him, he said, you know, when I hire younger musicians, I don't tell them too many things to do. And I said, well, why not? He said, well, man, you know, all the stuff I know is old. I said, whoa, check that out. So all the stuff he knows is old. That's what he taught me. So the shit I'm talking about is old, too. He said his thing is to play. He might tell them a few things, but he lets them figure out their way, because what they're doing is new. And he said if he plays strong enough, he can bring them into what he wants to do. So that forces him to become a stronger player, believe it or not, and learn something at the same time. So, you know, I decided I'm going to adopt that approach myself and try to, you know, surround myself with younger artists and learn from them, and hopefully they can pick up something from me, you know, because that's needed now. We have to keep the oral tradition a part of the music. We have to pass it along and make sure that the stories that at least I was fortunate enough to hear and meet the couple masters that I saw, I have to share that, but in a way where they're getting something out of it and I'm getting something out of it, not like a dictatorship. You have to do it this way. You have to do it this way. It has to be a common ground of sharing so we can keep this story going on, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's a niche for that I'm starting to realize that, you know, I think I want to walk into where I'm playing with younger musicians and, you know, and learning some new things and sharing some things, you know, that's a part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm trying to figure out sort of how to reach certain audiences in a way, because like there's people mm-hmm. who, you know, and I've been arguing this for years, is that you should never tell someone, oh, you should listen to jazz. You should tell mm-hmm. them you should listen to this album by this person. And it's kind of mm-hmm. happening, because there's people who don't listen to jazz in quotes, but they listen to Kamasi Washington, or they listen to mm-hmm. Christian Scott, you know,
yeah.
or Robert Glasper, you know? And so mm-hmm. it's a question of like, how do you bring somebody from the one artist they like into the broader world, you know?
Okay. Well, I've sat down and thought about that. You know, I don't know if that says I have a lot of time on my hands, but yeah, I think about it. You know, the correct answer is live and let live, which I am a proponent of. But I will say this, you have to be careful with the word new, you know, because the question is, what is the expiration date for the word new? You know, I see the new thing that's going on, but I'm seeing younger guys that are newer than them and just waiting for their turn to spread their wings and say what they got to say. So you have to be kind of careful with being holding the flag of, hey, not to say that that's what those gentlemen, Robert and Kamasi, I know Bob a little better than Kamasi. I've met him a couple of times. I've certainly seen him play and listen to his work. I'm not saying that they're saying this, but I'm saying that a lot of times I see articles where the new jazz, and this is the sound of that, you know, and I try to implore to younger musicians or even some comrades of mine to say, man, you know, it's not about new or getting an audience, you know, because when you're a jazz musician, you're actually like a Jedi. You know, you have to walk in, not in a three-dimensional way, you have to be four-dimensional about music and about this art form, at least in my opinion. You have to be someone who looks at the past, someone who's in the present, someone who's looking towards the future. And the fourth dimension is looking at all those three dimensions at once and being all of those things at the same time. And I think when you have a broader outlook on art like that, you know, the chances are you're going to learn more and you're going to meet different types of people, and you can appreciate more and feed your soul with the full story.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think about younger audiences, man. Honestly, I know this is going to sound selfish, you know, and it's not probably a good business model, but when I'm playing on the stage, man, I'm concerned with the music. You know, this is for me to express myself, because I need this vehicle to survive. I have to be able to express myself. And if I didn't express it on a saxophone, I probably would go out into the middle of the street and scream, which would therefore entail, you know, the banana truck picking me up and taking me to the loony bin.
Uh-huh.
So I pick up the saxophone. So that's my goal when I play, is to create art of course you need money to live and survive to do this, and you need an audience. But, you know, if it's young, old, or in between, or if it's no one there, and if it's no one there at the show, I play for the Angels. You know, that's what I do. And that keeps me going right there. So, yeah, I would love a younger audience to come to the gigs and appreciate that. But are we really at that place in time, at this time in history? You know, I mean, just misinformation that's put out there, you know, in terms of just everyday life, you know. It's a situation, there's a dire straits going on just with just people getting the correct information and being exposed to beauty, you know, and that's done on purpose as far as I'm concerned, you know, because I've never met a dumb person who listened to jazz. I've met people that I disagree with, but they weren't, you know, dumb, or they had a certain amount of intelligence. And I'm not saying that to be arrogant, but listening to this music or acoustic music or just great music, and not good, but great music, you know, there's a certain amount of intelligence that goes along with that and should be celebrated. But we're not at that point in time in the world. You know, people are, you know, taking a backseat to real situations. And, you know, but the art has to go on, and eventually people catch up. You know, times change. That's just where we at, you know, so.
Yeah,
I don't expect everyone to dig jazz, because some people are, that's just not where their heads are at. You know, they're just trying to make money and, you know, make their way through the day, you know. But, you know, they'll come around. But if a younger audience comes around, because if I'm playing with younger guys, then great. And if not, I'm still going to keep going on and doing what I have to do, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the gig that I mentioned at the Jazz Gallery, it's the website just says the J.D. Allen Group, and it doesn't say who's in the group or what's going on. So what are you, is that something new? Are you working on a new project?
Well, you know, I'm going to actually take a situation and deal with some younger players. The gentlemen, younger guys, actually, you probably haven't heard of, are going to be joining me for that. A bassist by the name of Ian McKellen and a drummer by the name of Malik Kali. I actually had heard of him, the drummer from Antoine Roney. And Ian is a great bassist, a young guy that's in town, and you can definitely hear about him. And he'll be performing with me at the Jazz Gallery. And at New Blue also, I think we're playing there also. So I'm starting to, you know, I met Ornette Coleman, man, and one thing that he really impressed upon me is to basically have your own tribe, you know, get... He said to have a group of people like mine, in the sense of wanting to get better, you have to have surround yourself around that. And I'm building my army of like-minded thinkers, you know, and those two gentlemen will be joining me. And I'm sure you're going to hear a lot about them in the future, you know.
Okay, that was my interview with J.D. Allen, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you'll visit patreon.com/burningambulance to support the show so we can keep it going. And I hope you'll come back for the next one. Osiris.